Hi, this is Dr. Siegfried Othmer, Chief Scientist at the EEG Institute, and you're listening to the NeuroNoodle Network Podcast.
Welcome to NeuroNoodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring our neuropsychologists, Dr. Laura Janssens, Dr. Skip Wrenn, and neurofeedback legend, Jay Gunkelman. Our goal is to provide information, promote options for better mental health. This is an all-star cast that are more than happy to share their knowledge with you. My name is Pete, and today we have on the show Dr. Siegfried Othmer, Chief Scientist at the EEG Institute. But before we get to Dr. Othmer, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Outrageous Baking and Interested Brain Hacker. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery that has been around for 15 years. They specialize in delicious gluten and dairy-free sweetbreads everyone will love. Skip, they ship all across the country.
I like to hear that, Pete. You know it.
So sign up for the newsletter now. Get 15% off your first order because we're all about gut health. Hey, ding, ding, ding. We have some new Patreon supporters to go along with Outrageous Baking and Interested Brain Hacker. We'd like to welcome aboard Tortalk and Sandhya M. Tortalk wants more people to discover TTS listening to text, and it can increase the efficiency and reduce stress. Tortalk, interesting, interesting. Welcome aboard, guys. You're going to have fun with us, I promise. And some business, too. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It really helps get the word out, so if they can't hear us, we can't help them. Okay, let's get to the main topic. Dr. Othmer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
How do you know Jay Gunkelman? I know everybody knows Jay Gunkelman, but how do the two of you know each other? It's always the first question I ask.
Yeah, it actually goes back to the 90s. And I don't know, I don't remember how we met. Probably at a Biofeedback Society of California conference, maybe one of the major conferences, AAPB, and that we may even have met before the ISNR was created, I don't know. But he worked at one of our offices in Marin County, at our Marin office in Marin County, during the neurofeedback. And so we interacted for a number of years more directly in that regard, and then plied his trade and we plied ours. But there was that time when we actually collaborated more closely.
Jay, what's your take?
I remember it as being one of the early versions of ISNR, either SNR or SSNR, one of the early ones, you know. And after that, I actually did a lecture in your course on neuroanatomy, neurophysiology for one of your courses. And then obviously the sublet of a big, we had a large suite in Marin, and the EG folks had a small portion of that. And Julian Isaacs ran that. And obviously, whenever he wasn't doing a patient, he would stop in and watch the EGs streaming by and point at a piece of the EG and say, what's that? So I spent a fair amount of time explaining what that was to Julian, you know, lambda and various EEG waveforms that were, different than just routine. And he would always ask, well, how do you know that? So I would point to Niedermeyer and he'd hand me the Niedermeyer book and I'd flip to the spot that explained the phenomenon that we were looking at. So I have the rattiest copy of Niedermeyer anybody's ever seen. It's dog-eared. The spine is broken in a number of spots from being flipped open so often. So most of the time, Niedermeyer is kind of a pristine book on a shelf, but as I say, my old version of it is kind of beat up. Julian is the one who invited me after my brain tumor surgery and everything to do a talk. And once I had done my first presentation, it was all downhill from there. I've been doing lecture presentations about EEG ever since. Thank you, Siegfried, for being along in the early days. My lab goes back to the 70s, but I had left neurofeedback for traditional EEG, and Siegfried's group and everything kind of brought me back into the neurofeedback fold, which is a good spot to be.
Dr. Othmer, how did you get started in the world of neuroscience, neurofeedback? I keep hearing stories in the 60s and 70s, but what got you sucked into it?
Well, actually, the story does go back that far because it also involves my wife. This has been a joint project. So the key issue is that we had a son with behavioral difficulties. This is the crux of the story, and this really wraps it up. So we were, you know, parents trying to struggle with a difficult kid, and the difficulties were getting greater and greater over time. And eventually, temporal lobe epilepsy was diagnosed, but that was many years in coming. So meanwhile, we as parents had only the behavioral model to go on, right? Brian, you have to control your behavior. What do we have to do, right? And he realized more than we did that he could not control his behavior. There were occasional violent episodes that were just out of the blue and whatever. And this is understood in the sciences, but in the medical field by some people. But that didn't rattle down to us. So we were totally mystified. And eventually got thrown out of school. And in the third grade, imagine that, an eight-year-old thrown out of school. And the pediatrician, thankfully, suspected a neurological involvement and got him on meds, and that improved. That was the first time when Brian was kind of liberated from the burden that we had placed on him as parents, right? He said, okay, it's not me, it's my brain. That was very liberating. And then it was sort of 9 years of hell because life, you know, the medications did their bit, but it was still not, he was still not livable with. 9 years later, we heard about the neurofeedback, which actually had been discovered right here in our neighborhood in Los Angeles at the Sepulveda Veterans Administration Hospital. And there was a practitioner in Beverly Hills, which was only 6 miles away from our house. We did a neurofeedback. And now that was the second stage of his liberation, because he realized, oh, now there is something I can do to help myself. And he just grabbed hold of that and said, this allows me to manage my condition. And it was truly a liberation. Now, that still didn't solve all the problems, right? But it was amazing how the change. He was, probably diagnosable as Asperger's, diagnosable as depressed, diagnosable as bipolar. There were paranoid episodes. I mean, life was rarely is one gifted with a child with so many difficulties. But a lot of that, came under control first with the meds and then again with the neurofeedback. And it turns out that my wife was studying at Cornell, first in physics, got a physics degree, and then she went into neurobiology. And her PhD topic, her thesis topic, her dissertation topic was actually closely related to what Barry Sternman, the original researcher in this field, was doing almost at the same time in Los Angeles at the Sepulveda VA. And so it was uncanny. She was working with cats. She'd implanted cat, electrodes in the cats. And she was working with a signal processor, capture the data and get evoked potential. So the field of evoked potentials was only about 2 or 3 years old at the time, right? And she was right in it, looking at classical conditioning of cat behavior using evoked potentials. And so she was geared for this field, for entry into this field. But then it was Brian's medical difficulties that actually derailed her PhD. She was now at the Brain Research Institute at UCLA, working under Ross Ady, its director. And she just got to the point where I can't carry on. I mean, Brian needs my full attention. She had her own issues. And so she basically just had to stop. And so that riveted us, when we saw Brian's progress, we both looked at each other and says, okay, here's this lady with a master's degree in education or something, right? Trying to manage this technology. And Sue's sitting there thinking, that's actually my field. So we were kind of, riveted by this. And so changed careers in order to pursue this. For a while, I stayed in aerospace because somebody had to make the money. We planned to go into this. And then that happened a few years later. built apparatus, first of all, that brought the whole technique into the modern world. And that instrument was sold to thousands of clinicians. And that kind of kicked things off. We started professional training in 1990, and then more fully in 1993 with the start of the SSNR. And so that was it. So we were in the early years on this project.
Can you give us just the time period with Brian and what when was that? The 70s, 60s?
Yeah. So he was born in 68, and okay. Then there was another part of the story, which is that he had a baby sister, and the baby sister had a brain tumor, and she died at 14 months. And that, of course, was very upsetting to Brian. And that helped to kind of set the rocks rolling down the hill, I'm sure. So there were both neurological influences, and then there were, what life dishes out to you. So that happened in 1975, and so that was a crisis that helped set Brian on the downward path.
To explain neurofeedback today, and for parents to help get their kids some treatment. I can only imagine what it was like in the early 70s. I mean, you had to create the trainings yourself, huh?
Yeah. But, you know, we did have a working model, and that wrapped around what Barry Sternman was doing. Yeah. And that pretty much set the stage. So the instrument that we developed really just simply computerized his lab instrument and the method that was implemented on his lab instrument. And so then, of course, innovation began, right? Once we had software, you know, if you have analog devices, you can't tweak the variables, you know, you're kind of stuck. So, but with software, you know, you've got latitude. And so that's when the innovation really began, and our thinking began to shift. And now this is the critical part of the story, because we're not there anymore. That is our conception of what's going on here has completely changed.
Let's get into that conceptual shift. That sounds
right. Okay. So basically, the operative model at that time was operant conditioning. Right. You're challenging the brain to alter state, because that helped to promote a more regulated state. Very clear, very simple model, proved out in cats and so forth. And increasingly, we began to appreciate the fact that the rapid results we were getting in the neurofeedback were not consistent with an operant conditioning model. Things were happening too fast. In fact, one of the other leading lights in the field, Joel Lubar, basically just said categorically, well, you know, if things happen in less than 15 sessions, that's not operant conditioning. But we were getting single session effects, no doubt about it. In fact, When we ourselves first did the neurofeedback, we were getting single session effects. Our son did, my wife did, I got saw effects in four sessions. None of that took a great deal of time, so that had to be explained. And so what had happened is the instrument was also showing the dynamics of the brain rhythms that we were using for the operant conditioning design. And so obviously the brain was lunching on the dynamics as well as on the targets. That the targeted reward that we were offering the person, the trainee. And so what happened over time is that we realized we gave ever more credit to the dynamics we were showing in the signal. And that got us to realize that there is an incredible specificity to these brain's response to these frequencies. And so that gave rise to what we call the optimal response frequency model. And that took us away, that liberated us from the standard frequencies. And then, of course, we were finding the optimal frequency, training frequency for every person. And then we noticed trends. The trends took us down to ever lower frequencies. This was the most challenging people that we were seeing. They tended to be at ever lower frequencies. So first we got down, you know, we kept changing the software to keep up. Then we trained in the theta band, for heaven's sakes, which we usually inhibit, and says, what are we doing here? And then we eventually ended up in the Delta band. And we said, my God, this is what we inhibit. What are we doing here training it? But we were training a mechanism. We're training a mechanism which is organized at a specific frequency. And eventually we are bumping up against the lower range of the EEG band. We're down here at 0.5 hertz, which is the usual cutoff of EEG band filters and so forth. And then we got a system that got us down to 0.1. And people were piling up there like snow drift against a fence. You know, they were sort of piling up at the lowest frequency. And then we said, well, you know, what to do? We have to go lower. I said, well, what does that mean? What does that even mean, training lower than 0.1 hertz? Well, it turns out that opened up an entire new universe to us. Because we did basically what nature directed us to do, which is train lower. I mean, whatever the heck that means. And so we got into this infralow frequency region, the region of the slow cortical potential. And that opened up a whole universe for us, because there is actually a whole universe of frequencies down there, right? 0.1, 0.01, 0.001, millihertz, and on and on. It just goes down. And it turns out that in that range, again, the rules held. People responded at very specific frequencies in that range. So this is very persuasive, and you get single session effects. People feel different, you know, within a matter of minutes if they're symptomatic, right? If they have something to report, if they've got a headache that might go away in a few minutes or get worse, in which case we have to, you know, we're obviously not at the right frequency. For the last 16 years, we've been exploring this low frequency range. And it turns out, what are we talking about here? We're not looking at the neural dance anymore, right? We're looking at whatever the brain needs to do to organize the low frequency regime, which is the regime of the glia. So the glial processes are low frequency. And it turns out they are essentially the governors of the neuronal system, right? It turns out that, you know, when you see a neuron picture and you see the synapse and you see the receiving end and you see the sending end, it's you basically see two elements in the picture, right? But there's always a third one in the mix, and that's the glia. The glia mix themselves in there at every synapse. They play a role, right? So, and it's a supervisory role. It's a controlling role. When you're talking about training the controls, the brain as a control system, you want to go to the top of the hierarchy of controls. Well, in the case of the neurons, that's the glia. And so it's the low frequencies that set the stage for the neuronal dance. And so there we are. And that I think has allowed us to say that we're heading for a major revolution in mental health. There's just no question. And it has to do with involving the low frequency range within the whole neurofeedback terrain.
So Siegfried, your approach is obviously not operant. And that kind of flies in the face of Sturman's adamant statement that, you know, what we're doing is operant conditioning or, you know, training. There has to be other explanations. And systems theory ends up being one of those approaches. Systems theory basically says that if you have a system and you provide feedback to the system, it can then self-regulate and change states. And this is, I think, something that explains the sudden change or the single session or there's no operant slow progression or gaining of a skill. It's a change in state and self-regulation. And I think the systems theory approach ends up helping explain your findings. And although it does challenge those that think this is all operant, it's also an extremely well accepted approach to systems. So I think what you're doing is got a solid basis. It doesn't have to be operant. There may be some operant aspects to some people's approaches, but systems theory also holds sway here. Even when people are trying the old-fashioned operant style, they still sometimes see single session changes, sudden changes, changes kind of out of the blue, and those are not explained by the simple operant approach. Operants easy to explain to people. Systems theory is a little bit more challenging. Yeah, just because it's a little bit more challenging doesn't mean it's not still a good explanation.
Yeah. Well, okay. But you know, a lot of our audience is as parents and so forth and people with the relevant issues that they're concerned about. So let me put that in other terms. The way we explain it is as follows. You're right that we're talking about state shifts in that are macroscopic and readily observable in first sessions, not necessarily, we're not accomplishing healing in a session, that it just sets us on the path. In fact, these state shifts serve the purpose of the clinician finding the ORF, and then the real work gets done at the ORF, right? Then, okay, so what's happening there? The brain is observing its own signal, the signal that it has itself generated. So it's the brain engaging with self. It is seeing itself in action. And that is actually an action item for the brain. Systems theory, all well and good, but we've got a living entity here that makes a difference. It's the living entity engaging in all of its complexity with this signal. And that is an action item for the brain. It immediately, first of all, the brain has to detect the fact that that signal represents itself, right? And as soon as it does that, as soon as the brain has that recognition, oh, that signal is me, I'm doing that. Then of course, the brain recruits that signal into its regulatory regime and utilizes that signal to improve its own self-regulatory competence in the longer term. We talk about that in terms of skill learning. It's a skill learning model with self-regulation being the brain's core skill. And so the brain is doing what it does naturally. It's now learning self-regulation in the way that it learned self-regulation in the first place, right? By observing itself living life. It has internal feedback loops, but it also monitors the external world and thus refines its regulatory skill. You know, obviously language learning happens that way, but also, affect regulation and so forth. It observes itself in the flow of life and thus improves its self-regulatory function. And now we're adding another feedback loop. The particular advantage of doing it this way is that we are operating at the level of subtlety at which good regulation necessarily has to take place. We're not interfering with the process. It's just we're letting the brain sit there with its own signal and manage it. If anybody's interested, I can show just how that process flows. I have some, I can show you briefly. Let me share the screen here. So here's the brain looking at itself. And, that's what the brain does. The brain only knows about itself, right? As Walter Freeman said, everything that the rabbit knows about the outside world, it makes up in its own brain. So the brain is always only engaged with itself. It's only operating in the universe of neuronal firing. So essentially, we're within that space. We're operating within that mode where the brain is simply engaging with itself. And here's the process. This is the usual process. Here's the trainee looking at the visual feedback. There's also auditory feedback and tactile feedback. Here's the amplifier. And here's the clinician looking at the data. Now, this turns out to be the drawing that's made by the engineer. And you notice his main task was designing this amplifier. And you notice it's right in front front and center. It's in the foreground here. This is obviously the engineer's drawing. In the real world, the clinician is paying more attention to the client. And so here we are in a realistic setting. So here's this kid looking at the train moving slowly because we're dealing with low frequencies. He can train even at this age for 10, 20 minutes. And here's the clinician watching the scene. And so here's where we are. Now, let me show a little bit about the instrument itself. So here we're seeing the feedback signal is obscured right now because we've got a crappy EEG. So this is not necessarily a good record. So here we have a decent EEG and we see the rocket going through the tunnel. When there's noise in the EEG, the tunnel goes dark. Here we see a spectral display, much of which is obscured behind here. So here we see the training ongoing. So the person is watching the rocket go through the tunnel, and the signal is now encoded in the speed of the rocket, right? Which is slowly changing. We're talking about very subtle effects that are actually beneath notice to the outside observer. But these subtle shifts are observable to the brain. And because, again, the brain is making that signal. So we're dealing at a very subtle level. And here we show all the inhibits, all the bands, the EEG bands separated into subbands, which are, this is part of our inhibit scheme. So this is the part that's conventional operant conditioning. So when band amplitudes are exceeded, then we see the darkness entering the tunnel, obscuring the rocket. And that's, again, a cueing to the brain that it's, going off the reservation. That's kind of the process. So that kind of illustrates the process. So the person is just sitting there, watching that signal and maybe engaging verbally with a client. And children in the adolescent age, they may be watching movies, in which case the signal is encoded in the size of the screen. The child is oriented toward the movie and the brain is oriented toward what matters to it, which is the growing and shrinking screen size, to which the person pays no attention, right? That just disappears. And so everybody's happy. So basically we just need to get the person out of the way in order for the brain to do its job, right? The person plays no role in the training, except to allow it to happen and not interfere with it. So this is truly brain training in its essence, and we're kind of letting the brain take charge.
Was that an infant you had? Like how old was that kid? That's great! Wow, I've never seen that before. Like, right. What can you train? What symptoms?
Well, okay. In this case, there was a situation where basically the kid was the wasn't having bowel movements regularly. So every time we'd have a session, he'd have a bowel movement. It was for minor issues. The kid is fine, right? Yeah. But that's just the point. This shouldn't just be looked at in the medical model. This should be looked at in an optimal functioning model. This can be done with young children, for example, with drug impacted children. They're born, dependent on cocaine. And we can calm that nervous system instantly. We've had kids, infants on the instrument as early as 3 weeks, and they're obviously responding. In other words, the brain of a 3 week old infant is capable of engaging with that signal, right? As soon as it recognizes that signal as representing itself, then the process moves forward. The interesting thing is that the infants actually pay attention to that signal, even though nothing particularly of interest to them. Infants probably engaged with things moving on the screen, that kind of thing. Okay, so they actually do pay attention. And of course, the brain assures that they pay attention, because once the brain is interested, the kid will be interested, right? So we think that these infants are looking at the screen because the brain wants it that way, right? So the brain is really in charge.
What do you train an infant for? Okay, bowel movements. What are you? Oh, I'm fascinated.
Colic, or if they are not ready to engage with a mother, if they reject contact, that kind of thing. It's not like we have a lot of experience with infants. We've only trained a few, but we know it's possible. But the main application in our society, I think, is going to be drug impacted children. Coming out drug dependent, and then they don't want to give them cocaine. I understand that, but we need to shift the state of the nervous system, and this is the way to do it.
Can you talk about what's being trained to do that? So if you're training down the nervous system with someone, say, addicted to cocaine, born addicted, what's look
happening?
Like?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, sorry. Okay. So the nature favors us here. What happens in this process, as soon as we start this training, people calm down. They move to a lower arousal state, unless we're, you know, wildly at the wrong frequency. And, you know, and we're talking about very dysregulated people, you know, ordinary folks wiring up and doing this training, they're not going to, nothing dramatic is going to happen. But if we're talking about very symptomatic, highly dysregulated people, then we may not be able to predict readily what's going to happen when we start at a particular frequency. We then have to initiate a process of finding the right frequency. But in that process, if we're even close to being right, the consequence is for people to move to a lower arousal level. They move to a calmer state. So we're moving toward parasympathetic dominance. You know, it's a relaxation training. It's the relaxation training par excellence.
There are a lot of people who want to know what to do, how to do it. And they ask for instructions on what do I do to make this work? My answer to that is always, if I could tell you how to do this with words, talk therapy would work.
Yeah. And then I wouldn't have to have an instrument. Right. So this is our method in particular reduces the process entirely, almost entirely to an instrumental one. Now, the clinician role is by no means irrelevant because the key issue is the clinician has to decide two things. Am I at the right frequency? And am I at the right protocol? And now, you know, let me just frame the big picture here. We're moving to the bottom of the regulatory hierarchy of the nervous system, right? We're training core regulation. What is core regulation? It's where the nervous system hangs out in terms of arousal level, in terms of parasympathetic dominance, and in terms of stability. You know, the prime responsibility for a self-organizing system is to maintain its stability categorically, right? That's the ground rule. That's the prime directive. It turns out that those two requirements, state regulation, where does the nervous system hang out, and nervous system stability, drive us in two separate directions. The calming of the nervous system drives us to lower frequencies, and the more impacted people move to the extreme low frequencies, frequencies that are hard to imagine. Brain stability requires very specific frequencies that are all over the map. They can be all over the EEG. They can be in the EEG range. That's where we discovered this. And they can be the infra-low frequency range. And there can be a number of such frequencies where the brain can be trained towards stability. And now what has transpired is that brain stability is principally a matter of the coordination of the two hemispheres. They live in their own universe to a large degree, but of course they have to collaborate. They have to interact on everything, right? But they do have their individuality and so forth. So they have a rather daunting task, and that easily goes awry. So we find that the core issue and instabilities, what are we talking about here? We're talking about rage. We're talking about migraines. We're talking about rage is more complicated. The classic ones are seizures, migraines, panic attacks, asthma attacks, that kind of thing. These sudden major excursions of state that majorly diminish brain functional capacity, or constrain brain functional capacity. Those sudden, you know, paroxysmal in character, sort of burst-like in character, they appear suddenly and disappear suddenly, that kind of thing. Those are brain instabilities. And by and large, they involve the hemispheric relationship. And so when we train the brain in its hemispheric coordination, of course, we don't. We let the brain do it. We just give it information on what's going on at each hemisphere. These good things happen with regard to instabilities. And it turns out the same thing is done for all of them. Whether a person has asthma or migraines or panic attacks or whatever, vertigo, the same technique is used. So obviously there's a fundamental principle at work here. And then the calming training, the arousal level training, a very effective way of getting at that is right parietal placement, Because first of all, the right hemisphere is in control of our core regulatory function. That's the burden of the left is to control the EEG range. The burden of the right is to control the ILF range. So it's in charge of the glia and the glial system. And it's parietal, it's posterior, because the posterior hub actually is more important. It's the most important part of the brain in this model of core regulation. You know, the frontal brain is more our view to the outside world, the paternal brain, if you will. The posterior is more the maternal, looking to our safety and so forth. I mean, these are oversimplifications, all of them, but nevertheless, we found our way to the right parietal region, which is just magical for arousal regulation. For anxiety and so forth. We also do right frontal for certain kinds of anxiety. So the plot thickens after a while, but in terms of starting people off, there are these core issues: arousal regulation and brain stability, right? And that occupies us with the most critically dysregulated people. That occupies us for quite some time, because that's where things are messed up, at the core issue. Now, we can talk also about who these people are, but let me see if this is understandable.
You brought up glial mental health revolution, and we're about to be in one. Can somebody talk to me and the moms and dads what that means and what that's going to look like? What is the revolution?
The revolution is this. We now know that when you confront your child in all its difficulties, there is no way to predict what the potential of that nervous system for recovery is. That the child simply has to be given the opportunity to do neurofeedback. We have no idea where that might go. Best example is our own son, right? He was not livable with. I mean, he was a horrible human being. He tortured our younger son, Kurt, mercilessly for years, and in these altered states that were sort of subclinical seizure activity. And yet he turned out to be this wonderful human being. There's no way to tell, confronting your child's difficulties, what is possible with neurofeedback and everything else. We want to bring all the help to bear that we can. But these tools are becoming available. But the heart of it is brain training, is the brain rescuing itself. It's the brain having this access to information, which gives it its access to the self-rescue remedy. And that's we're seeing just amazing recoveries in autism and so forth. The children become unrecognizable with respect to their own past. So one child who is now in college was asked, would you be willing to give us a testimonial, and he said no, because I don't want anybody to know that is who I was years ago. I'm not going to bring that up, right? That is in a deep dark past, and I'm not going to talk about it. Not going to tell you about it. That's gone. And we understand that. We had a mom coming to us, telling us about the progress of her autistic child. And she said, okay, this is not to go out of this room. I'm showing you the videos. I have my son to worry about. He's going to grow up. I don't want him seeing himself on the internet as a four-year-old screeching at his little sister, right? I don't want that out there. So you have to keep this inside this room. The point is that huge change is possible that hasn't been before.
In autism, 40% of the autism population have classical epileptiform discharges in the EEG without having seizures. And another 20% have paroxysms that just don't have a spike in them, but they're absolutely out of control EEG patterns. And we've seen those patterns dissolve with the neurofeedback. And autistic kids who weren't able to speak and couldn't even look people in the face end up coming off of the spectrum. And because you can't catch autism, we can't say we cured autism, but they've learned how to not be the way they were. And if you can stop the epileptiform discharges, the brain works a heck of a lot better without sudden electrical storms happening. We've seen stability induced. But we also see some kids that are amotivational, lack of initiation, under-aroused, just not even interactive. And we've seen those kids reactivated and re-engaged. The brain can be locked onto something, but it can also be locked off. So it's astounding to watch this process with kids who are all the way from epileptiform content to under-aroused, amotivational lumps. And both of those extremes end up becoming a normal child. I've had a series of intractable epileptics that I've worked with which were having hundreds of seizures a day, already medicated with three anticonvulsants, lined up, ready for brain surgery. And when the parents decided to try neurofeedback, a couple of these cases, the doctors told them basically, if you do neurofeedback and don't do brain surgery, you're going to kill your child, which is a rather aggressive bedside manner, actually. The parents were adamant that they wanted to try neurofeedback before brain surgery cut out a piece of their temporal lobe. You got to understand that the brain surgery, you know, classical brain surgery where they snip off the first third or half of the temporal lobe, which is an older style surgery, only had a half a chance of a reduction in seizures at 3 years. At 3 years after the surgery, when you're actually looking to see what the impact was, only half of the people had a benefit. If you only have a half a chance, it's kind of hard to imagine lining up for brain surgery. The newer techniques where they actually just go in and take out a small piece, not the first third or half, the success rate drops to about 30%. It's less invasive. It's less destructive. The success rate drops. What they're trying to do is cut out the seizure. The seizure is a network property. It's not a focus. People might have a spot that triggers the network, but you can't cut out the network. You know, they're hoping to take out the trigger point, but that doesn't always happen. I have a whole series of EEGs where people have had a left temporal or a right temporal resection, and the other side is firing away, still giving them seizures. The first do no harm. Before I would line up for brain surgery for epilepsy, I would try to learn how to operate my brain using neurofeedback. Again, we have a series of six intractable epileptics with horrible uncontrolled seizures already lined up for brain surgery, which are now seizure-free, medication-free for multiple years. You know, it seems miraculous, but it's just nature. The brain learns to regulate itself. It's astounding the amount of self-regulatory control that the brain can institute.
Yeah. Let me pick up on that. So the critical insight is that seizure activity is basically a network property. The question, you know, foci exist. Maybe you can find them, maybe you can't. But there are places in the brain where this stuff gets initiated. Okay, but then the question is, does it generalize? And that's the network issue. Basically, we're dealing here with a genetically mediated condition, perhaps, that may be then exacerbated by brain injury. But the genetic contribution is hyperexcitability. So the brain is too firing ready, right? Well, you handle that as best you can with pharmacology. But then there's also a network aspect of hyperexcitability, because when we do our training without involving pharmacology, we actually calm that down. So the neural networks and these self-regulatory processes are also an influence on a factor in hyperexcitability, in this probability of generalization of the paroxysmal event into a seizure. So yes, we definitely have a role, and neurology doesn't know about this. This is really, you know, they're so insular because, of course, they're incapable of learning from anybody outside the field because we don't exist. You know, that's just the way of academia. can't even talk to these people. I think, you know, Jay has found a way to talk to a few of them, but basically the door is shut as a general principle. So this whole field has emerged outside of academia because the government stopped funding this back in 85 and developed into a mature discipline. And of course, we're still only at the beginning. So this really does justify my statement that we're looking for toward a revolution in mental health. What I wanted to get back to is who are these people who are so intractable? Not perhaps in terms of seizure activity, but just in terms of mental health, the mental health universe. We are, of course, talking about the people who did not have a healthy start in life, right? And in particular, they did not have a healthy emotional start in life. So a lot of these mental health issues are rooted in early childhood problems. This is now very well known. What isn't known is just how far this goes. We talk about adverse childhood events, being lying at the core of a whole raft of relatively intractable mental health issues. But it's worse than that, because if a child is not in an absolutely positive upbringing, right? If he doesn't learn to love, which means he's not in a loving environment, right? You need to be loved in order to learn to love. If that is not the case, if they look working, you know, being raised in equivocal families that are not there for them and so forth, there's problems afoot that will carry through the rest of life. And now the nice thing is we can go back and rescue those people. The problem is rooted in these in the organization of these lower frequencies that are organized early in life, right during those years, right? The early task of the human brain in the first 18 months is affect regulation, learning how to live in this world. And that's you're teaching your autonomic nervous system, you're teaching the arousal system, and it's basically mediated through the affective relationship to the parent. And if that is equivocal, doesn't go well, the child pays a terrible price health-wise, not only mental health, but also physical health. And that is the big story, because we now can take, regardless of that history, we can now go back at any age and fix that. The years that are lost, we can't recover, but there is a price paid. But basically, we can give them a healthy life going forward. That derangement of the core networks, right? That orientation to threat, that orientation toward the lack of safety and so forth, that is fixable. And you don't do it with talk therapy. You can't do it with talk therapy. Now, I think we're coming to the end of the hour, but I might just, if there's another moment, I can slip in here that the way I think about this is the president and the Secret Service. The Secret Service keeps the president safe, and he has no say in that, right? So psychotherapy is like talking to the president about the problems of the Secret Service, that it's being too protective and too, threat-oriented and so forth and can't relax. Why don't we talk to the Secret Service? Well, the Secret Service is not available for talking to. This is our neurology. Our neurology, if we're not brought up in a safe environment, our neurology is organized for threat. And that is costly for the entire rest of life. And that the brain needs to climb down from that. And that cannot be done with talk therapy. That has to be done with something like neurofeedback.
Alan Shore's work about early life experience of the infant face-to-face with the parent ends up being very important for understanding the development of the neurotransmitter system and the attachment that ends up going on. He's done some very nice work on that with primary emotion as well as social emotion, like shame and guilt later in life. But his writings in this area, I think, are foundational and well worth a read if somebody's going to end up trying to understand the dysregulation that ends up happening due to poor initial interactions.
So Dr. Othmer, you talked about the mid-80s is when the government removed funding for neurofeedback in the research here. And so we're talking about, over 30, 40 years of trying to bring, the phrase isn't bring it back, but get it more integrated into the mainstream. And so my question for you, or, you know, if there's a way that you can comment, like what do we need to break through? Like, you know, you talk neurology is kind of deaf to our cause here. What do you think we need to bring it more mainstream?
So wonderful question. So as it happens here in Los Angeles, we're working with the Pritzker Foundation to bring the neurofeedback into agencies that are dealing with underserved children, right? This is foster care facilities. This is a Department of Mental Health. This is the Violence Intervention Project. This is a program that works, a seventh generation working with the Native Americans. There at the moment, this is just really started off in this past year, and already we're at 19 agencies involved. And there's another program Matt Fleischman started in Eugene, Oregon, once he retired from full neurofeedback practice. We called it the Neurofeedback Advocacy Project, where he's trying to get this into agencies in Oregon, first of all, but they're also in Louisiana and elsewhere. So this is It's the strawberry model, you know. The strawberry plant puts out runners and then starts a new strawberry plant. So it's going to go bottom up. This is not going to come in the front door. Academia doesn't want to pay any attention to this and so forth. No, it has to come bottom up. And so we're dealing with the children where people throw up their hands. I really don't know what to do with these kids, right? And they're violent kids and so forth. And these are the attachment disorder children, right? Drug impacted and whatever. This is exactly where we need to be. But in our professional lives, we couldn't serve those people because we were in private pay situations, right? We had to make a living with private pay patients. And so we never reached these people. And now there we are. So this is within a year or so, we're going to have enough numbers in the database from these projects that program managers will pay attention to. We'll simply not be able to ignore because the data are coming in quite solid. And once that happens, once people are looking at major reduction in resort to medical care and emergency room care and so forth, and the demand for services goes down. Once people see that, this is going to take off. And then I think we're going to have something like a phase transition that all of a sudden people will go, well, I knew it all the time. You know, yeah, it's just that, you know, well, I just wanted to see some research published and blah, blah, blah. There'll be a phase transition where somebody, you know, lots of people will suddenly want to be on the right side of history. So it's where have you been for the last 40 years? Darn it. You know, I can't talk to anybody at UCLA. The door just slams shut, right? They can't talk to it. That's the way with academia. So it's going to have to come bottom up. And that's what's now happening with the aid of the Pritzker Foundation, which is funding the early insertion into these agencies to the point where it can then take off. Once the state realizes how much money this is saving them, you know, even bureaucrats will realize we just got to do this.
Dr. Othmer, oh man, awesome to have you on. Thank you so much.
Well, happy to be here. We can do it again.
We are. Look for the invite. What's the best way for people to learn more about you? Is it eeginfo.com?
Yes, that's where the research is. And there's a YouTube channel.
And we'd even get to the Brian Othmer Foundation.
That's our nonprofit, which collaborates with the Pritzker Foundation. Yeah. Yeah, we can talk about that next time.
Oh, thank you so much, Doctor. We thank you all for listening to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. Again, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Outrageous Baking and Interested Brain Hacker. We are really about the gut health. Visit outrageousbaking.com. Gluten-free, everyone loves. Plus, our new Patreon supporters, Tortok and Sanda Mehta. Tortoks want more people to discover TTS listening to text, can increase efficiency and reduce stress. Everything will be in the podcast notes. Do you have an idea for a topic? Please email pete@neuronoodle.com or leave us a voicemail. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to our YouTube channel, smash that like button on Facebook, Instagram, and follow us on Twitter. And hey, if you really, really like us, like Interested Brain Hacker, you can buy us a coffee on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. We love our Patreon people. Cue the music.